General Burke's Reel 3.
The front visors could only be lifted about 45 degrees, which gave the driver and the officer a view of the front horns of the tank and very little else. You had to get your direction from these periscopes, which were not very effective. We had, the driver and the officer had two small round periscopes, which you push through the top, which gave you an additional, quite clear view, but a very restricted field of vision.
Now, when I was asking you these questions about how vulnerable you felt, I was particularly thinking about this phenomena of splash.
Yes.
Could you explain to me what that was and how big a problem it was?
Well, the tanks were put together. There was a certain gap between the sponson and the main hull of the tank. There was a certain amount of daylight, and machine guns firing on that, the bullets split up on impact and poured in hot steel through the gap. I could show you on the tank quite easily where it came in. They were badly finished. We were issued with strips afterwards, which screwed in to just hide the gap and paint it over, but they weren't bulletproof. But there were a tremendous number of casualties through splash, particularly in the face. And that's why we were issued with visors for Combray, which nobody used, because they you got hot and they slipped, and you could see less through them than with them. Mm. But the splash was a very important point. Had a lot of people with eye trouble and face trouble with it.
We've talked quite a lot about tanks from the point of view of the tank crew. I wonder, as regards the attitude of other arms to tanks, whether you got at the time any impressions of how, for example, the infantry felt about tanks.
Well, the infantry who had any knowledge of tanks wouldn't come within a mile of them because they attracted all the enemy fire. The mugs got close to it because they thought they could get shelter. That's what it was. I think the infantry had a great respect for us, particularly if they wanted anything pulled out of the mud. But they were dangerous things to get near.
Could we talk a bit about some of the ancillary equipment of the tank? From the point of view of how useful and satisfactory it was. You've already explained that you had masks to protect eyes against splash. There were various other items of equipment that were introduced to be used with the tank. I wonder if we can just sort of talk about them one by one. Like, for example, the unditching gear. How did that work and how useful was it?
Unditching gear was a godsend. There were two types. There was the original type, called the torpedo unditching gear, and it had two shortened beams which fitted onto each track and enabled the tank to get better grip that way. Unsatisfactory because you got an uneven pull on it, and that was replaced with a solid beam, a teak beam that ran the whole width of the track. Chains from the beam fitted onto the track, and you drove the tank forward onto the beam, as it were. That was most satisfactory, and it was an absolute lifesaver.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow that. Could you clarify that a bit for me? How were the beams attached and carried and
used?
Well, the
beams had chains fitted to them with bolts. And they were fitted on, you got outside to fit them on, or you could fit them on with difficulty inside through two flaps in the rear of the tank. You maneuvered the tank so that the chains came opposite the aperture and then screwed them on to the tent, gripped in like that. And that was most effective. They were difficult to fit. And of course the real trouble was, if you got ditched, you got a concentrated fire on you, you had to get out to fit your own ditching beam. But they were very effective.
Now, there were other items of equipment, weren't there, which were also designed to help the tank's mobility. I'm thinking of fascines, for example. When were they introduced and how did they work?
The what?
Fascines.
Oh, fascines were a special introduction for Cambrai, and they were introduced down at the assembly place, I think it was Whaley, and they had one sole object, the Hindenburg line, which was the first of the German lines, being dug deep down to make it tank-proof. The theory, or the practice, being that when a tank goes over a big ditch, big trench, its nose dips, then it goes through, and then it starts to rise, and the engine is insufficient to pull the tail up. The tail drops, and you get that vertical appearance which you see in pictures. Now, the fascine, you dropped in from the nose, and when the tail started to drop, it hit the fascine, and you rode up. It reduced the angle of ascent, and you pulled yourself out. That worked most effectively. I know from personal experience at Cambrai, I used my fascine on the Hindenburg line, which is an enormous obstacle, and it came out quite easily.
You told me how you were issued with the masks against splash and how you tended not to wear them. That made me wonder whether the helmets that were issued to you also proved an encumbrance inside the tank.
We never had helmets. They were out of date at the time we got there. The original people did. I mean, they had the same trouble, banging their heads and so on and so forth. The space was so limited that you short of a skull cap, you couldn't have anything.
Yes. Now, other items of equipment. There were those nets that you used to carry on top of the tanks.
What camouflage nets. They had bits of coloured cloth on them, on a netting, and you put them over the tank, propping it up so that you wouldn't define the actual shape of the tank, and they were rather effective against, not only against ground observation, but against air observation. They were camouflage nets. They had them in this last war. They worked very well. The drawback to them, they got wet being on top, and they were frightfully heavy. One got rather fed up handling them. But they were effective. They were very good.
Was there any other kind of ancillary equipment of the kind we've been talking about introduced while you served on tanks in
the war? We had the tank sheets, which were tarpaulins. They were useful. Not only did they cover the tank up, but they afforded shelter for the crew from the weather. We had spades.
They were to dig yourself out with, were they?
Dig yourselves out. I'm just trying to think what was. I don't think we had much else. We had the unditching beam, the camouflage nets, and the tank sheets. That was about all. Mm.
Now, I know that on the Western Front, tank casualties were quite high. How was salvage and repair organised within your battalion?
You had to, first of all, try and get your own tank out. If necessary, go back at night and get it out. That was your first job. And until you got sort of dismissed, as it were, from your tank, you were stuck to it. And we had a salvage detachment. I'm talking about the salient. Under Major, the Honourable R.T.R.P. Butler, he was a terrific man. He used to go out at night with two or three mechanics and with a spanner and a tin of petrol, and he rescued tank after tank and drove it back himself. He was a salvage king. That developed up into a salvage which turned into Remy. But the salvage was done in the salient by Bob Butler. He was a great man.
If he couldn't get a tank mobile under its own steam, as it were, did he have recourse to salvage machines to tow them in or anything like that?
The crew generally, he had to, but the crew generally went and stripped it. First thing you took off the clock, they were rather good. But you did, you took everything, you took, the very first thing you took off were the portable armament, your secondary armament, your Lewis guns, and your ammunition. That was the first thing you, after all, that's the British Army lay down, isn't it? You to keep your guns with you. And then you took off other stuff, say like clocks and so on and so forth, magnetos, anything that could be used again and was portable. But the hull you just left.
Yes, there are quite famous landmarks on the Western Front.
Yes.
From the point of view of mechanical reliability in the battlefield, did individual tanks have their own peculiarities and idiosyncrasies?
Well, it did indeed. They were as wayward as women. They did the most extraordinary. As I said, my own tank was a real, most doubtful proposition until it boiled. And once it had boiled, it was a steamer. It went like wildfire. A lot of them had petrol trouble. You got that because it was gravity fed, and if you got it very hot inside, you got a vacuum, and there's of course a stoppage in the petrol. We had quite a lot of that, but you got to know it. And then we had, after that, it was succeeded by the AutoVac, and the AutoVac, the valves used to get hot and used to stick. And the first aid for that was to hit it with a spanner. And then they started off again and you went on.
Which was the first operation you were involved in France?
The half one was an advance towards the Zonnebeek. I think it was the Zonnebeek, right? And the core ammunition supply was done by means of a light railway running up a Deckerville track. And they had tank crossings. They had ramps of sleepers, and they were flagged, and we crossed over on those. Otherwise, we destroyed the Deckerville, and we couldn't get the ammunition up. My tank, of course, got halfway over and stalled, and there was a train coming along, and there was a driver wasn't watching what he was doing, and he hit me broadside on. It split the tank, which saved me going on, which everyone was very thankful for. And, of course, the engine, it didn't do it any good at all. And that put off the core, that particular limited core offensive, for 48 hours. Everybody tried to blame me, but it wasn't. It was the tank engine had stopped. That was a half action.
Yes.
Which was very satisfactory.
And then there was the Saint-Julien attack.
Saint-Julien one was... That was a savage rabbit one.
Yes.
I think that it was a pillbox on the left of St. Julian, just up the Zonnebeek. I think it was called Mousetrap Farm.
Yes.
And that was short in and out,
there was an afternoon one. There was a standard procedure for dealing with pillboxes, was there?
Yes, one was, got hold of the infantry, found out what their precise intention was, and then went ahead of them and plastered the pillbox with everything you'd got and put the infantry in. It was, I think I'm right in saying, it was rather unique, that particular thing, because it was done in the afternoon, in broad daylight, without any artillery preparation. It's a surprise in and out business, and it was most effective. We all got back safely.
And what other operations?
Well, the other one, of course, was the final operation in the Ypres salient, the attack on Paul Capel.
Yes.
That was a disaster.
Yes. Tell me about your experiences in that action, right from the beginning, what the objectives were and how you began the operation and how it worked out.
It's a little long-winded.
That's all right.
But the road runs from St. Julian, left-handed northwards, to Paul Capel, and there it split. One ran into the French sector, and the other ran due east into Roulers. And, of course, the Roulers plain was untouched. And that was the end of the Passchendaele Ridge, beyond Passchendaele. And the objective, final objective, was the capture of Roulers, which was all baloney. And the first one, the intermediate objective, was the capture of the brewery, Paul Capel, which the Germans had hung on to and was blocking the whole thing. I think Maxey was a commander, a corps commander. They decided that they must reduce Paul Capel village and then swing right-handed, swing east, up onto the Roulers Ridge. They were prepared to use every tank they'd got. Well, that consisted, the rest of the tanks had gone south. It consisted of 11 company. We had 9 tanks, 3 sections of 3. The ground was so appalling then, but it's right at the end of, in the beginning of October, the end of the season, that to get off the road was quite impossible. We went up and had a reconnaissance, and we decided that we could just stick to the Pavé Road. It would take us into Paul Capel. The Pavé Road was slightly wider than the tanks. It was only a matter of about 6 inches either side, so it required skillful driving. And the plan was to take our tanks up into St. Julian, which is our property by then, leave them there overnight, go back the next day, and at dawn, go down the road to Paul Capel. The naval division, I think, were operating with us. When we got to Paul Capel, one section was to keep on into the French zone, and the others were to go up and capture Roulers, which was outside our petrol limit, but that didn't seem to matter to anyone. The thing went off perfectly well, according to plan, up to the time we left St. Julian. I remember it well, it was 6:15 was 0 hour, and we moved off down there, 9 abreast. I was the third tank. And we all went well for about a mile. Then we came to a tree which had been, whether it had been blown up or blown by the Germans or fallen, I don't know, but it was a very big tree, plumb across the pavé. The first tank got over it. The second tank slewed left and got into the mud and was just a write-off. I had a very good driver, and we got over it quite successfully. We could just see the section commander, Hugh Skinner, in front, and we were getting on quite comfortably. This almighty crash came on my starboard side, and it blew in the doors and part of the engine, set fire to it, and we got out. By that time, we were in a double barrage. We were in the tail end of our own barrage, and we just caught the German defensive barrage. And it really was very unpleasant. It was very dangerous. The next tank behind also got over the tree, and he came along, and I went back to him and told him that the road was blocked. I had blocked it as well. And the only thing to do really was to turn back. He had a very good driver too, and he turned on the pavé, which is a tremendous feat. I don't know how he did it, but he turned round, and we went back, and then we came to the tree, and the rest of the company were there, piled up in the mud, just stuck. I had one, my first gunner had lost his leg, and we evacuated tank, and I got rid of him. Then we got a stretcher, I found a stretcher party. They were very brave, some of those fellows. And they took on the rest of the wounded, because I had three of us left. And we walked back to a field ambulance. I remember having a frightful row with a sister there. She was very forward woman, with a doctor, and the thing was labelled stretcher cases only. And I'd got these three chaps left, plus my wounded, walking wounded, and she said, "You can't come in here." And we settled it, we did. And I got back onto this duckwood, duckboard. It had duckboard paths. Got back in duckboard track and evacuated the crew, and that was a lot. We were, couldn't, nobody could say very much to us because only two of us left. Mm.
This operation you've just described, what battle was it a part of?
It's part of the Passchendaele. It was the final Passchendaele attack.
Good.
I think you'll find it was October the 17th.
Thank you. Well, this leads us on to Cambrai, but before we talk about that, I wanted to ask you what morale was like in the tank corps before Cambrai, in the light of the experiences which you'd had.
Careful what I say.
Oh, don't be careful.
Yeah.
That's the last thing I want you to
do. The individual morale, what I call the internal morale, was tremendously high. It always was. I never struck anybody who didn't feel that way. But the feeling towards the higher direction, the staff, was just about as low as it could be. They smelt. And that's when we heard we were going to move south. Morale leapt right up in the air. Mm.
What was the basis for that low opinion of the army staff?
Well, if you're put in a tin box and shoved along a road which is a death trap, you know if you get off you get bogged. And you repeat that way, and there's no sort of end. I mean, the Roulier thing was just rubbish. One couldn't have got it, even with modern tanks, one wouldn't have used it as an objective at all. I don't think it came from any malicious thinking. It was just, nobody had any idea of tanks at all. They couldn't be bothered to think about them. In terms of guns and barrages, and walking wounded, that was their limit. The idea of a new weapon like a tank. Right up to the end of the war, people didn't think much of them. You don't know very much.
What was the earliest indication you received that this big operation that ultimately took place at Cambrai was on?
Well, the first we got was one evening. I remember Corporal Watson, was our company commander, said that the company was moving the day after next south to, I think it was Haydown. And that I'd be the rear party. Being a junior officer, I would be. And we moved off eventually by lorry. We went down to Haydong, and there we found this intense activity making for scenes. We made our own.
And how did you make them?
Well, you got faggots. We call them faggots. And they got the right number, can't remember how they were, and they laid them out on two chains. And you fix one chain to the tank track and put the other chain over to the track and then reverse the tank, and it squashed the fascine. When you got it squashed, you chained it up again and then lifted it on by the tracks onto the top of the tank.
I see. Good. Thank you. So there was this intense activity.
They lifted it. And then, two or three days later, we had the first time, I think, at a staff conference in a hangar, and Boney Fuller came and gave us the lowdown on what they hoped to do Captain Combray, and how all the tanks were going in. We didn't believe him.
Yes. Tell me as much as you remember about that briefing from Fuller.
I don't remember very much about it, because... But we were given our areas and our objectives, and we were just told to go on. We were told to go on to our third objective, and then the tanks would be out of petrol. They would come back to rally. I remember perfectly well, no account were they to come back to the start line. They would refill and they'd go on the next day. That was the broad... I was only a second lieutenant. That was a broad issue of the thing.
So I'm still not very clear how this was presented, what information you were given as to the targets and the purpose of the operation.
Well, Fuller gave us the map showing the German positions and where what the German strengths were. And somebody came and gave us the going, which was very important. It was unspoiled. And we were then told, we were detailed for reconnaissances forward to see the ground and so on and so forth. And the starting day, was given to us, and our objectives, and that's about all.
Were there any other special preparations for the operation apart from the fascines and the briefing?
Well, they laid a lot of emphasis on secrecy, which was quite right, and it was kept very secret. And they laid a lot of emphasis again on the assembly areas, which brought us up into a place called Havrincourt Wood.
How did you manage to maintain secrecy with so many tanks involved?
Well, there were no aeroplanes, or very few aeroplanes then, and we didn't move out of the area, we remained in it. And there was nobody else there except the 4th Black Watch. They were there, and they did a certain amount of practice with us. We did do, it's quite right. We had a 2 or 3 days with them. But you can keep secrecy, you could then in France, because there was no movement. I mean, the peasants were restricted to sort of donkeys and so on and so forth. They couldn't go very far. And the troops just... Well, we were so busy working on our tanks and so on and so forth, they didn't want to go very far. There was nowhere to go.
How did you manage to keep secrecy when you were moving up? Because so many tanks must have made quite a lot of noise.
Well, we moved up the first bit. Going back to 4th Black Watch, we had these two exercises with them, and most of the jocks wouldn't come near us because they thought they were fearsome monsters.
The officers were right, but the jocks wouldn't.
We went forward in two bunches. I'm trying to think. When the first half we went by rail, and I think the detraining station was Ytres. I think, in fact, I'm certain it was. That's where we detrained. Going up by rail, we had these wrecked tanks, and we took a company at a time. A hazardous business, because you had to pass from one truck to another. And if you were the leading one and you bumped at all, you put the truck off the rails. But we went up to Ypres, and we landed there shortly before dusk. And in moving forward, I'm talking about my company, moving forward from then to Havrincourt Wood, we went very slowly, placed a fair distance between each tank, and almost silent. It was uncanny. I forget how far it was. It must be about 2 or 3 miles, something like that. We slowly went into Havrincourt Wood, which was within extreme machine gun fire of the Boche, and there were no fires allowed. at night. No smoke by day. We were there just over 24 hours, about 48 hours. No gathering of crews. And they were very, very strict about it. And it was observed, because well, we knew what would happen if we were spotted. And the day before...